What in the world are they thinking of us in the rest of the world? I mean, we're all over cable TV now and soon in the movies. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, we meet the host of yet another reality show that dips into Alaska. In fact, into subsistence. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. We meet the host and main character of the Travel Channel's The Wild Within, Stephen Rinella, straight ahead on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Okay, so here's this guy. He opens up the show, showing us his freezer in Brooklyn, New York, and talking about how he's filled it all up with food that he's went out and obtained himself. I mean, this is in Brooklyn, New York. And he proceeds to take us to Alaska, to Saltery Cove, which some people listening to this will know, on Prince of Wales Island outside of Ketchikan. And he goes and, well, he gets some shrimp and some crab and a bunch of meat on the show. And that's the first episode of The Wild Within. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve Rinella.
Hey, thanks for having me on. That was a great summation of the first show. I wish I'm going to steal that from you and start using it.
You're welcome to anything you can grab and take away, buddy. It's a pleasure to have you on. I knew you as the author of American Buffalo, a book which, was about 3 years old now.
Yep, yeah, it came out in December 2008.
And it is In Search of a Lost Icon. Anybody wants to know about the bison and the hunting of such and the history of such is probably the best book you would get, certainly among the most engaging. And you came through Alaska on a book tour for this, and I missed you for the show, and I've been wanting to get you ever since. When the Travel Channel pitched The Wild Within, I said, yeah, I definitely want to spend an hour talking to this guy.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you had the time.
So I guess the perception that I got from watching it really wasn't the final cut, but the first episode of The Wild Within, which I believe breaks on the Travel Channel next week.
Yep. So the show airs, The Wild Within airs Sundays at 9 p.m. So be sure to check your local listings and make sure that goes with your time zone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they got a West Coast listing and then they have an East Coast listing, and we usually go by the West Coast one. Yeah. Well, I've only seen this one episode, but it's pretty clear that this is what you do. You are documenting your own, I don't know what you say, exploits, is that the right word?
We can use that word for now. Yeah, the premise, well, let me speak to the first episode too, because the premise behind The Wild Within, so the operating premise, is something I actually kind of lifted from a writer named Thomas Whipple, who died in the 1930s, fought in World War I. He had this great quote where he said that, speaking of our American ancestors, he said that they lived in the wild but had civilization inside of them. And now we live in civilization, but have the wild inside of us. That's kind of my operating thesis with the show. And what I do is that wild that's within us, in my mind, is that of the hunter-gatherer. In the first show, you're going to get introduced to me. You meet several members of my family. You see my place where I live. You see my cabin that I have on Saltry Cove in Prince Wales Island. And it's kind of an introduction into my lifestyle. And that is going to be a jump off where viewers are going to then come with me and go explore other cultures around the country and out around the world and find commonalities that bind all modern-day hunter-gatherers together, whether it's Amerindians in Guyana in South America or some cowboys and hunters who live in West Texas.
Some people will remember, if they don't know anything about this show, they haven't seen the promos for this show, The Wild Within, or they haven't seen or read American Buffalo, they may still know about you as the guy who went out and hunted down all the ingredients for a huge banquet from a legendary cooking book because that's how kind of how you got started here, isn't it? The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. Why don't you tell me a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, that was my first book. I started writing about the outdoors and travel and other things professionally, you know, I guess 11, 12 years ago. And then my first book began when I had come into possession of a snapping turtle. I had been telling some friends of mine in Montana about how we used to eat snapping turtles when I was a kid. And the next time I went home to my home state, which is Michigan, I told them I was going to bring a snapping turtle back. And sure enough, ahead of one of my visits to Michigan, my mom called and said that she had secured a snapping turtle for me that had been crossing the road. So before I went back and got my turtle, a friend of mine in Montana came and gave me this book called Le Guide Culinaire, The Culinary Guide, written by a chef named Escoffier. And a good way to remember who Escoffier was is everybody knows the term like putting on the Ritz, okay? That refers to a guy, Cesar Ritz, who was a famous, he ran hotels. Ritz ran the hotels, and Escoffier ran the kitchens in the hotels. And in 1903, he wrote this magnum opus, this giant compendium on French high cuisine called The Culinary Guide, and it's over 5,000 recipes. And he's considered to be like the first guy that really sat down and codified how to cook all these things. And these guys back then ate tons of wild game. They didn't call it that, but their diet was comprised of wild game from all over the world. What I set out to do then, starting with this turtle, is I set out to create a feast from the Culinary Guide. And I spent a year traveling from Florida to Alaska and California to New York, collecting all the ingredients that I could hunt and fish for myself from Culinary Guide, and in the end, through a 3-day, 45-course feast with those ingredients, and had friends of mine coming from around the country, and it was a huge celebration of wild game and wild game eating. And that became my first book, Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. And that, and working on that book actually got me much more interested in wild game cooking, because growing up, we deep-fried everything we got our hands on. I mean, we deep fried everything. And I learned from starting on that book, I learned that there's a lot more you can do. And you guys in Alaska know that better than anybody, man. I mean, you know, there's the variety of preparations in Alaska with like smoking and curing, you know. I mean, you guys get where I'm coming from.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people get where you're coming from. And I think they'll be wondering what kind of impression you're getting across here. But I think the Wild Within, as you describe it, is probably pretty accurate for what you want to say, which is that there's a part of people's natures that they really probably could do with getting better acquainted with.
Yeah, I think that, well, one, I think that it's important to keep in mind, and I think and your viewership or, you know, your listenership's going to understand this, is like, in my mind, you always hear the term, like, if you kill it, you eat it, you know, but I also feel like if you eat it, you kill it. And that's why, you know, when I'm home, you know, my family, we live on a diet of wild game. I don't want to act like that's the only thing, because like anyone, I wind up in restaurants, you know what I mean? So I don't want to be deceptive and act like that's it, but at home, that's what happens. And it's funny because I have an 8-month-old son, Jim, and 2 nights ago, my wife finally gave me the green light to introduce him to meat. And so his first taste of meat was a little minced up rib meat from an Alaska black-tailed buck. So that was a great moment there for me.
Yeah, yeah, and that's in the movie. I mean, in the show.
I introduce that that's what it's going to go toward, and I stayed true to my word. I was either going to give him some elk or some deer, and I remembered my pledge and gave him the deer meat.
Well, it just seems that from a point of view of the business, the publishing business, the book writing business, the television business, the media business, whatever business it is, and they're all sort of coming together these days.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm kind of interested just, you know, in how it looks like you have basically taken an idea and managed to keep it going and make a living with it. And that you're doing whatever's necessary. Like, for instance, an American Buffalo, and we saw this come in like 10, 15 years ago, you really didn't publish a book, especially of your personal experiences, without a bunch of pictures. And so here you are. Anytime you are somewhere, you generally will have a picture of it in the book.
That, Yeah, I wanted to prove the veracity of my claims, you know. So yeah, I used pictures.
Well, you're so lucky.
There's been a lot, you know, as you know. I mean, you know, you follow the news enough to know that, you know, the nonfiction industry had been racked a couple times by deceptive claims, and my publisher Spiegel and Grau, she does not like that at all. And it was funny because, you know, magazine articles are very rigorously fact-checked, but when I was working on that book, I would have people often asking me at the publishing house to submit pictures of things, just because they wanted to rest assured that I was there and that's what happened.
I never even thought of that. I mean, to me, the reality of it just rings all over the place. I mean, you talk about being on the Copper River and you talk about waking up with grit in your teeth. And there's a bunch of people listening right now that know exactly what you're talking about.
You wouldn't make up a detail like that.
Yeah.
As for like the general trajectory of, you know, what I've been trying to do, it's kind of funny how it came around, because I started fur trapping. You know, when I was 10, my two brothers and I came into a bunch of muskrat traps, and we started, well, not a bunch, but we accumulated a bunch over time. And started trapping muskrat, and we started trapping mink and raccoon. And, you know, this is at an age when you'd mow someone's lawn, you know, for $10 and think it was a good deal. And we could trap a muskrat and sell for $4.55. So it was real money to us. And our father very generously shielded us from a lot of our overhead costs and helped, you know, help us get a hatchet and get some traps. So it was just pure profit. When I started trapping, I mean, I stuck with it until I was 22. And by the time I was selling hundreds of pelts a year by the time I was 22. And I really thought that I was going to make a go of that, and I was going to make a living at it. And the fur market got bad.
Boy, didn't it.
Around the time I quit, like in 1997. I mean, it's been bad since, but it was bad. And I just eventually realized, like, I cannot make a go of this. You know, I cannot make a go of this. And the first thing that sprung to my mind, I don't know why, but I'm glad it did now. The first thing that really sprung to my mind was the idea that I would become an outdoor writer. I was like, I wanted to be in the outdoors. And in my mind, it was like, first, when I was really young, I was going to be a mountain man. Then I realized I was 200 years too late. And then I was going to be the next best thing, a commercial fur trapper. And then I, you know, failed at that for various reasons. And then I was like, okay, stage of attempt three was an outdoor writer. And I've been very lucky and just real blessed by the industry. Now I've been able to do a lot of different things, you know, like start magazine articles, books, now I'm doing TV. And I think that it's a great opportunity for me because it allows me to do a lot of stuff. But I've also been feel very privileged and almost kind of humbled by the fact that I'm able to introduce some of these ideas and introduce this lifestyle and try to translate and articulate a bit about the hunter-gatherer lifestyle to people who it would be completely unfamiliar to.
Oh, absolutely. So you're it looks like you're basically doing this with a very minimal crew. I mean, your trip to Alaska, and this is true in America Buffalo too, which is, you know, centers on a trip. Basically, you're lucky enough to draw a bison hunt permit, and then you actually have to go out and try and get the bison, and that's not very easy in the Wrangles. And so you do this, and you've got your brother goes along with you, and he lives here in Alaska, Danny. And in fact, he's welcome to call at 1-800-478-8255 or 550-8422 or anybody else's, for that matter. In Anchorage is a local call at 550-8422.
I guarantee you that there are people who ate that animal listening to your show right now. It got widely dispersed around town there.
Well, that's a lot of meat. Come to think of it, I might have gotten some.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that at all.
Well, we are speaking with Steve Rinella. He is author of American Buffalo and host of the Travel Channel's The Wild Within, which starts on Sunday night in Alaska with a trip to, out of Sultry Cove. But, I mean, you and your brother have this cabin down there then on Prince of Wales.
Yeah, we bought about 7 years ago. Me and my two brothers, Matt and Danny, then another friend of ours, Dan Bogan, who's another Anchorage guy, and we all pitched in and bought together. We had become friends with another gentleman who lives on Solitary Cove by the name of Ron Layton, and it's such a long, convoluted story about how we met Ron Layton, but Ron Layton really introduced us to the area, and we did some work with Ron and various chores with Ron, and he showed us a lot of things about shrimp and crab, and eventually a place opened up down there, so now we're neighbors, and then him and his wife Joan, we spend a lot of time with them in the summer, so it's kind of become our one of our main getaways. And you know, you get older. I used to all I like when we were kids, we'd hunt and fish in the fall all the time together. And now, you know, my brothers and I, you know, our lives just get more complicated, and that place gives us a good little retreat to go hang out and live somewhat the way we'd always lived, where we're just out on the land, you know, enjoying ourselves. So it's been a real asset to have that cabin.
Well, you were, I mean, this is pretty strenuous, some of the stuff that you show yourself doing on there. I was trying to imagine who was carrying the camera, and it seemed like it was pretty much you and your brother.
You know what? I'll tell you something.
and a tripod.
There's a constant distribution of gear around, like a behind the scenes gear maneuvering, yeah. And we had stuff. It wound up being such a mess. What happens in the episode? Just to bring your audience up to date, there's this mountain behind Sultry Cove, and it's a heavily timbered mountain, and underneath this timber, there are a lot of cliffs. But it has a flat alpine surface on the top, and there's a lot of deer up on this top. Going up, you wind up dodging around so much in really thick alder and thick underbrush and dodging around, and it's kind of squirting around all these different cliffs, and you pick a way up, and you have to be very careful to find your way back down again. So we go up there with the camera crew and all the things, and unlike a lot of other shows, This is like a shameless plug for myself. Unlike a lot of other shows where they act like, oh, we're this survival show, but the guys are actually racked out in some lodge, you know, we actually camp out. So we're up there, camera equipment, camp gear, doing the real thing, and we make, on the way down, a big mistake and do not follow our route down. And it came down to where, you know, we're rappelling down cliff faces, and at a point, it got so bad that we weren't even filming anymore. Everything was shut down. You can't afford to lose cameras in a situation like that. So we went from making a TV show to just trying to save our own asses. You know, and we were like, it got pretty sticky. There was a couple of little arguments brewing, but we lived through it. And as a crew, we came out even stronger and less inclined to not pay attention to where we're going.
Yeah. Well, do you think this? I'm wondering if this expedition. I mean, I can't even imagine that the viewers would not enjoy this, you know, coming along in this type of. I don't know if I'd call it an adventure, an expedition. Let's say.
I like that. I like that term, expedition. I really feel like people will like it, and I think that people. Here's something I think that people who are familiar with the outdoors. A conundrum they have when they're presented with their life, the way their lifestyle might be put forth on TV, is hunting gets one of two treatments, I think. There's a popular version of hunting would be like the generic, you know, like the survival show formula, where, you know, some guy from England, you know, he's like let's say you fall off a cruise ship and you have nothing but your knife and some technical clothing, and you have to, you know, eat the eyeballs out of a platypus and then rush back to town before something bad happens to you. And so there's like that type of hunting, you know. Also, you have hunting shows that are strictly trophy hunting, where the complete focus is on the animal's antlers or horns, okay? But those aren't the kinds of hunting that I think really strike home and that really reverberate with most of the hunters in the world. And so I think that this show is a great chance for people to see a form of hunting, which is an educated, contemplative look at hunting for food. And I think that it'll be refreshing for people to see some of their values and some of their perspectives reflected back to them in a way that is at least recognizable to them. For people who have no background in hunting, I'm not proposing here that they're going to watch this show and run out and go for squirrel or go for rabbit or go for deer. I think that might happen, and I think that some people will see it and be inspired. But if they're not inspired to go do it, I feel as though they'll at least understand it better, and they might understand relatives or friends who do it and better understand where they're coming from. And hopefully, when people hear about issues surrounding hunting or issues surrounding habitat preservation or issues surrounding access to land, they might remember some of this and realize that it's not just, you know, gun-crazed maniacs out there shooting stuff for sport, but it's a legitimate, heartfelt pastime.
So I think you're quite ready to defend the point of killing what you eat. As a matter of fact, I sense, Steve Ranella, that you're pretty passionate in that particular area. And perhaps there are some listeners that want to take up that issue with you. You know, I know I was just having a New Year's dinner with a bunch of people that were vegetarians, and they didn't like it that I was eating a piece of steak. And then
Hey, Steve, you know what? I'll tell you this, though, man. This is something I think about all the time. If someone comes to me, right, and they come and tell me I'm categorically vegetarian, or let's say categorically vegan, which means, you know, no, you don't even eat animal byproducts. Like, just so I might be telling everybody something they already know, but, you know, vegetarian doesn't eat meat, but, you know, vegan, they're not going to touch fish. They might not even eat honey, no milk, okay? If someone comes to me and they're categorically vegan because they think across the board it is wrong to kill an animal for human purposes, I'm not even going to engage them in an argument. I respect where they're coming from. I respect that they're able to maintain that kind of moral consistency, and I have no interest in trying to change their mind. I don't have any animosity toward them. It's like they've come to a pretty strict interpretation of something, and that's great because they've probably thought about it plenty. I disagree with it, but that's fine. I'm going to leave it be. What troubles me, though, is people who are perfectly comfortable, and this is an old argument, but what troubles me is people who are perfectly comfortable eating meat, wearing leather, doing all the things that involve animal slaughter, but then acting somehow as though they're above hunting or they disapprove of hunting. It's such a weak perspective to have, to say that the killing of animals is okay, as long as out of my sight and I don't know who's doing it and I don't know what they're doing, then it's fine. But if I meet the guy, then I have a problem with him. It's like an infuriating perspective for me to deal with. And I always try to understand it. I don't understand it. And the best I can do is I think it's just a form of willful ignorance.
Well, yeah. And you know, not wanting to see it. I mean, there's that part of it. Well, so long as we're on controversial things, let's do a couple more. What do you think of predator control? There is a move in Alaska to, as they say, enhance the consumptive uses of game at the expense of the predators, especially wolves. What do you think of that?
I'll say this about predator control. I think that it's important. This might not be a satisfactory answer for you.
Well,
but
yeah,
that it's important. When considering predator control, I think it's important for people to realize that there are a lot of differences between different regions, and you cannot lump the entire western U.S. and Alaska into one thing and act as though the case in one position is the case in another position. And to comment on Alaska, I want to talk about Montana for a second. Montana has some areas, particularly around Yellowstone National Park, Glacier National Park, and the huge compounds of national forests around those, that have very stable, growing populations of grizzly bears, growing populations of wolves, okay? But there are other areas a few hundred miles away, maybe 1,000 miles away, where people are trying to get those animals reestablished. The tricky part comes down to being able to say and being able to explain to people that just because an animal is missing from the ecosystem here doesn't mean that it's categorically endangered somewhere else. And I think that people have to learn to make these decisions on a case-by-case point and look at the needs of a certain area and needs of the people. And I also think that the needs of locals should trump the needs of people who are looking at it from a distant perspective and don't totally understand it. The same way, I live in New York now. I do not find evidence of a lot of Alaskans sending a dictation to New York about how people in New York should be living their lives, that they disapprove of what they're doing. It's just, In New York, we do not hear complaints from Alaska. So it's a little frustrating to me to see how much attention Alaskans get from people who aren't familiar with their issues. And this isn't to say I'm not trying to come down the fence in either way. I'm just trying to articulate the point that I think that these are cases that need to be decided by people who live in a place and that they should have their perspective heard on a very regional basis. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't want to be evasive about how I don't want to answer the question, but I think that that's an important point to make.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have, the fur market, it's an object of huge resentment in Alaska and economic difficulty for anybody that was trying to trap when the fur market died out because it became very unfashionable, you know, due to pressure groups. It's pretty simple.
Yeah, and it's
though.
Like, I just don't, and it seems like in general, pressures emanate from urban areas, and they emanate from urban areas and impinge on rural peoples.
Yeah.
It's just a trend. There's, you know, people, you don't have to be, it's easy to see how that kind of situation breeds a lot of resentment.
Yeah, and but I would tell you this, I would know enough that it, no matter how cold it got, if I was visiting in New York, I probably wouldn't wear my beaver hat.
You know what though? This is really funny because I was just driving down the road a minute ago. I'm doing, you know, various press things.
Yeah.
I was driving down the road and I commented to someone who was in the car with me how much fur I was seeing. It almost made me feel warm.
Yeah. Well, I had a last fur I inquired about, they said, "Oh, it's fake."
No, I'm telling you, man. You might. There's a lot of real fur. I've been hanging around here going on. Well, I got married 2 years ago and was here full time. Been here longer than that. I've been noticing an increase in fur. Take it for what you will. But I think you're going to introduce even more controversial topics.
Oh, yes. And this one from Denny, and he's saying, "Hey, wait a minute. This guy comes up here in the summertime. What about people that are here year-round? Where does he get off for a person coming in only in the summer, filling up their freezers with fish and game, and then heading south again?" I'll let you handle that.
Well, I'll say, I don't know. I mean, I think that in one way, it's a pretty open, free country, and I own property. I go up to my place. I have family. I hang around. That might be upsetting to someone. Sure, I can understand. I don't really understand where they're coming from because
but you're not really competing with them.
I believe in like kind of the democratic principle of being able to move around with freedom.
Yeah.
And
right.
I hunt in a lot of places. A couple of days ago I was hunting here in New York. I don't know. Sorry. What's that guy's name? Denny.
Danny. Yeah, Denny. Not Danny.
Yep. Denny. Sorry, Danny.
Yeah. But I don't think in any sense that what you're doing is taking food out of the mouths of an Alaskan.
No, I reckon not. I don't think we're talking quite that scale.
All right, we're talking to Steve Ranella. He is author of The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, American Buffalo, and host of the Travel Channel's The Wild Within, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Steve Ranella, do you happen to be listening to that announcement there during the break?
I did.
Isn't that something?
That was a good announcement.
Subsistence Management Council. Looking for people, especially Native people, to serve on these councils that would advise the federal government on management for subsistence.
Hey, my neighbor, good friend, Ron down in South Dakota, he's real heavily involved in that, and I always like to hear his stories about those issues. He's got great perspective. He's a good educator on those things as well, and he actually comes down to travels around quite a bit, goes down to Washington, D.C. and things, and preserving subsistence rights.
Well, let's go to James, joins the program from Wrangell. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Steve Ranella.
How's it going?
Good.
I just had a couple points. I really like this show. This is great. I mean, I got a double thumbs up for this show right now. You know that? I got more respect for this guy than anything. I cannot believe it. You know, I run a traditional foods program down here with a bunch of kids and trying to teach them how to get back into, you know, nature, hunting, and fishing. And I hope everybody watches this show, man.
Oh, hey, thanks a lot. It's funny. I know a guy who'd be kindred spirits with you, a guy named Andrew Radulowski, who runs a similar program in the San Juan Islands off of Washington, so quite a ways south of you, but the same thing, and working with school kids.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. You know, I'm trying to get these kids back into all this and realize, you know, at the same time, I got to be jumping into the politics of it and talking to the Forest Service, because they are taking our roads. They're decommissioning the roads where we hunt, where we do our subsistence fishing and hunting, and it's hard to, you know, I bring these kids out clam digging and out shrimping and out doing everything with them, just trying to teach them, you know. And half the thing is, it's not even kids half the time. You know, I've had people that are 50 years old with me that are like, I've lived here my whole life and I've never done this, you know, and their eyes are just wide open. And it's a great thing, man. I hope that show just does awesome for you.
Yeah, thanks. You know, it's funny, like certain people, you know, you look at how much certain places can actually support, you know, and how much extraction could go on for personal use in some areas. And, you know, and I would never like advocate and say that in this country, everyone's going to be able to go out and live on wild game. They're not. And I don't advocate over harvesting, you know, on a personal level. But I think that when you're talking about with kids, you can change someone's entire perspective. Just doing something as simple as taking someone out to hunt for a squirrel. And to cook that squirrel up, it doesn't mean that they're going to become a lifelong hunter necessarily, but they'll always look at their food differently and they'll look at their environment differently. I think just with a single experience like that.
See, I grew up here in Wrangell where, you know, a lot of people don't have money. There's not a lot of income here, you know, and I, you know, I shoot a lot of deer a year. I go out and I shoot, you know, 15, but I do it legally. I go up to the Forest Service and get subsistence hunting programs, and I bring people out with me, and I hunt for elders, a lot of people that just can't afford the meat, you know. I was like, I live off of this. I live off of moose meat, deer meat, you know. I go clam digging. I do everything. I buy the season, but, you know, I just joined the U.S. military, so I'm out of here. I'm going to go to the East Coast now. But
no, watch out, man. And that's the thing. It's a funny thing to come on, and you know, a lot of the times when I'm discussing what I discuss and I'm trying to, like, spread a certain message around and providing entertainment for certain people, you know, a lot of times I feel as though I'm talking to people who maybe are completely unfamiliar with the ideas that I'm putting forth here. But to come on and do a show in Alaska and beyond talking to an Alaska audience, it's almost like, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, man. I mean, I know that in Alaska, people in general, this is a generalization, but some of the people I know who live as close as possible to the land are very astute about issues going on around them, about habitat issues and access issues. So in some way, I'm telling people things they already know. But, you know, perhaps there's some guy in Alaska who, you know, listens to this and might look at his own fellow statesman differently.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing, is you got to open up everybody's eyes so they can realize what's going on, you know. You know, I have a couple of buddies. I worked down in Washington for a while as a welder, and I had a couple of buddies that were vegan down there. And my family sent me down deer meat and everything when I was down there, and I came in, you know, at lunchtime around the table, and he was like, hey, man. I was like, it's deer, and he kind of looked. By the time I left that table, he was already eating it. So I was like, you know, it was totally changed. You know, I didn't
listen, man, I have had – I'm glad you called. I've had that identical experience. I can't tell you. I probably more than 10 times.
Yeah.
And in fact, a couple nights ago, I was eating. I had some elk that my brother had sent me from Montana, and I was eating some elk meat. And a friend of mine was over who doesn't, you know, a friend of my wife's saying, I don't eat meat. I don't eat meat, but I'll eat that meat. Put it in her mouth, loved it. I told her, like, where it came from. Talked about my brother, how I hunt my brother, how he lives in Miles City, Montana, where he hunts with his bow, told her the whole story. And she looked at it, and it was like, it became like a recognizable thing to her, you know, and she popped it in her mouth. And I didn't make a big deal out to her, but it's fun to see that happen, you know, to see people wake up to, you know, kind of the pleasures of game.
James, I want to thank you so much for your call from Wrangell. Hey, James. Bye-bye now.
Nope, he took off.
Yeah, that's all right. I think he figured his point was made. I one time saw, and actually it's happened more than once, saw a vegetarian take a trip to Barrow when the whaling was on, and they came back, and they weren't a vegetarian anymore.
I can imagine. It's funny because, you know, I was saying earlier, like, if someone's really committed and thought out what they're saying and they're consistent with their thing, like, I don't have a gripe with it. But one thing I do notice about vegetarianism, it just doesn't travel that well. It's like, you know, there's a lot of places where you're going to go around the world, and it's just not going to work.
Yeah, and there is a, you know, hunter-gatherer. I mean, if you look realistically, the gathering is probably a bigger part of the diet than the hunter.
for the hunter-gatherer, you know, that's an interesting point that you bring up, and it's, you know, there's an ongoing debate, and it's something I've always been very interested in, is the idea of the idea of the first Americans, like, you know, the first people who would have migrated across the Bering Land Bridge from Siberia and populated the New World. And there's this image of them, conventionally, there's this image of them as that they're, you know, killing woolly mammoths left and right and feasting on huge slabs of meat. And in time, anthropologists kind of looked at that and realized that the reason they think that is because we're talking about 14,000 years ago. And not much is still around from then, but huge bones tend to turn up in these sites because everything else is gone. And there's been a rethinking on the role of gathering and hunting and gathering. And early human sites probably were not leaving behind now all the evidence of all the vegetable matter, shellfish, invertebrates. All that evidence has vanished. And it leaves you a pretty slim perspective on what was actually going on. And I've read other things where people have looked at hunting and gathering cultures. And when you look just at caloric intake, the women doing the gathering might, for their clan, be providing 70% of the calories.
Right, yeah.
And the men are providing 30% of the calories.
Well, while we're on that Landbridge issue, I wanted to, in case you are not staying up to date on it, I don't know whether you're, you know, want to stay up to date on it, but keep your eye on the issue of the younger Dryas, because I rather think that the paleo history is yet to be written about the Bering Land Bridge and all that, pretty much.
Oh, I know. I'm familiar with the younger Dryas, and yeah, I know exactly what you're referring to. And it's like, it's a constantly fluctuating field. It's one of the most fascinating fields.
It is.
The peopling of the New World, I mean, it's just an amazing subject. And one great thing that I love about Alaska is that going to some of those places, and I've been up around, you know, the foot of the...
You got to go to the Mesa site. You got to put your hands on those artifacts up there. That's
great.
Yeah,
it's like, to go up there, you can really kind of see it and picture it in a way, because you can stand in a place like that, like the Mesa site, and imagine those hunters who stood there. And really, not many people have been there since then.
Yeah.
Some people passed through, but periods of years, of tens of years, might go by without someone stepping in that spot, specific spot you're stepping. So the history there is very alive.
Yeah, and the continuity, even, you know, almost up to modern times, of people just being up there and watching and chipping away at their rocks, you know.
Yeah, and observing the landscape. Yeah, it's like, you know, there's something, that's one thing I always appreciate about history. Like, there's this area in Montana, the Missouri Breaks, and we do an episode on the Missouri Breaks. And we do an episode on Lewis and Clark and their travels through Montana and the hunting and gathering they did to support their expedition. But it's funny, like, a place like Missouri Breaks is very remote by continental U.S. standards. And it's kind of like, and a friend of mine who's a writer, Ian Frazier, he once commented to me this, like, it's like Lewis and Clark came through this stretch of the river and camped there. And then nothing ever really happened after they left. It's like you can still, like, sleep in that spot, and it's kind of like history stopped at that moment. And it's a wonderful, like, for that reason, it's a wonderful place to go and hunt and to live off the land a little bit, because you know you're seeing it in a very ancestral way.
Wow. And that'll show up in the show, The Wild Within, one of the episodes?
Yes, sir. That's the second episode.
All right. Well, that's great to hear. We're speaking with Steve Rinella. He is the host and main character in the Travel Channel's The Wild Within, which starts on Sunday night. And it starts with an episode in Alaska. He's also the author of The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine and American Buffalo. And Bob joins the program from Anchorage. Bob, you've been so patient. Thanks for calling.
No problem. With the magic of hold, it, I can eat my subsistence eggs.
Oh, you're keeping chickens.
Hi, Steve, and Steve. It sounds like you're a very effective spokesperson. I look forward to seeing the show, and I probably shouldn't judge it until I do. But I think you're much more comprehensive and thorough about it than perhaps your television competition covering hunting.
Well, you know, I hope so, but the verdict will be up to guys like you.
Well, I mean, right. You know, the ones I am accustomed to is that, gee, Bob, look at the size of that bass. Yeah, that sure is a big one there. Well, let's just see if we can reel her in here. Let me get that net.
Well, I was thinking of Sarah's grand and glorious.
I thought you might have been.
Oh, yeah, we didn't talk about that, but... Yeah, there's a lot of things I don't understand there, but I don't know.
But I wanted to raise a less controversial subject, or perhaps not. You've kind of touched on subsistence, but not from a perspective of the issue within Alaska, going back.
I use that too. Yeah, for me, that's another funny thing about talking to people in Alaska is there is a subsistence category there, And so you run into a confusion of terms, and I might use the term generally, you know, might be better for you guys would be personal use, you know, strict personal use. So I realize that if I've caused some confusion there, it's because you guys actually have a legal category there for subsistence, and I use it for a general audience. I use it to mean that you're doing these things in order to utilize them and eat them at your home.
I understand the distinction clearly.
Sport or trophy.
I just wondered whether your show will attempt to deal with subsistence hunting and fishing rights for Alaska Natives. It's been such a big issue since 1980. The allocation, when you talk about one person's not going to affect the resource, but as habitat declines and there's pressure on the resource, some very tough allocation questions have to get answered. And it's been a divisive political issue up here to the point where we have a patchwork quilt of regulatory system now where the federal government controls hunting and fishing on federal lands and the state on state lands. And that was a direct penalty clause out of this federal law. And that all gets kind of murky, and you're probably not trying to do an educational show, but I just wonder, are you going to try to grapple with any of those tougher issues?
You know, unfortunately, no, and I'll tell you a couple reasons why. One, it's not something that I feel like I'm knowledgeable enough to talk about other than to express to people that it is an issue and that it has serious repercussions for people on both sides of the fence. I don't know enough about it to even have a comment on it. Secondly, the reason the show is not going to touch on it is you're dealing with a finite amount of time, and it's just really impossible to get into complex issues like that that are nuanced in a show with this format. So as much as I'm sympathetic to the debate and I understand the debate, I can't, you know, with a straight face tell you that you're going to find a satisfactory answer to that within this program. It's just something for a whole different conversation, and it's something for someone who's closer to it, such as you and your friends. It's something for people who are closer to it to talk about. I'm just not equipped to even comment on it.
That's a fair comment. Thank you very much.
All right, Bob. Yeah. Thanks for hanging on to get that point in. And it is, yeah, I'll tell you this, Steve Rinella. There are places in Alaska where the customary traditional way of hunting is being disrupted by, guided hunters that are brought in, and that basically distorts, as you can easily imagine, the population and the dynamics of the game species they're used to subsisting on. So it can get pretty controversial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. And it's like, and you know, I know I almost feel like a broken record, so I keep bringing up the same thing, is that a lot of, you know, in Alaska, I know enough about Alaska from friends and family who live there. In Alaska, a lot of these issues become much more complicated and much more divisive than in the rest of the country. I've done over the last 10 years, lived in and did I lived in Montana for 11 years, and I got to know that state very well. And it just doesn't have – it has a completely different set of management issues. It's recreational, personal use hunting only. So the debate there becomes like land access issues. You're talking about just the right to hunt or the right not to hunt. And there's not a lot of these gray areas of different kinds of hunting. But one of the beauties of a place like Montana and you know, Michigan, anywhere I grew up, the places that have deer, is that it's possible to supplement your diet year-round. In most places, for people who have the energy to do it, it's possible to supplement your diet year-round with wild meat. And when you look at it, you go to a burger joint, and you're going to get a quarter-pound hamburger, okay? Now, one deer, let's say you kill a 120-pound whitetail deer. That deer is going to have 45 or 50% yield. So you're looking at, let's say, 50 pounds of meat. That right there is 200 hamburgers, okay? Now, when I'm talking about the kind of hunting and the kind of lifestyle I'm living, what I mean is when I sit down at night for my dinner, when I sit down for my lunch at dinner, that my protein, my meat is coming from food I've hunted and fished. And of course, it gets supplemented all kinds of other ways. I garden, I do other things. To start discussing and making recommendations to people who live in rural places where their diet, maybe their diet is, you know, 95% wild protein they're getting from the wild, I can't sit here and say that I know how they need to resolve their disputes and resolve their issues. I trust that it'll get worked out, but I don't want to even hint that I'm the man to have an opinion about this kind of stuff. Right. It's really for people to decide.
Well, how about this question from Dan by email, who says, hey, I think hunting is a great thing. I love to be out of doors, especially in the fall. However, unless you're living among the herds, if you think that hunting is a way to provide for you and your family, you're kidding yourself. If you add the cost of equipment, transportation, especially in Alaska, it would be considerably less expensive to buy a beef cow. I'd like to hear some discussion of this. I don't think you're going to dispute that.
That's a great point, man, and I think it comes down to quality of lifestyle. Like, I could say to you, like, let's say you go to you go on vacation, all right, whatever you do. Let's say you go to vacation in Hawaii, all right? I would say to you, wouldn't it be a lot more economical to not go on vacation? Like, wouldn't it be a lot more economical to not go out on a date with your girlfriend? Wouldn't it be more economical to just set your thermostat at 33 degrees so your pipes don't freeze? There's a lot of things that I'm not proposing here. I'm not like a thrift expert, and I don't think that most hunters look at it strictly as a matter of thriftiness. It's a lifestyle choice. It's something that matters to people, and that they look at food as more than just calories. They look at food as more than just something to fill their gut. I think that, you know, even all around the world, but definitely in the American mythos, is like there's a quality to what you eat. And people are willing to pay more money when they go to the grocery store. They're willing to pay more money for organic beef or free-range beef. They're willing to pay more money for organic produce. And people are routinely, across the board in all facets of life, willing to pay extra for the things that matter most to them. And hunting, for me, I cannot present it as an economical issue. I'm not a commercial market hunter. I don't hunt. Like, the money that I use to pay for the things I need does not come from hunting. My food comes from hunting. And so, yeah, it's a perfectly valid point. But the thing is, I don't want to buy a beef.
Right. Okay, we're talking to Steve Vanella. It's Talk of Alaska, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
On The Wild Within, the initial episode, which takes place out of Saltery Cove, most of it up kind of on a bluff, a hill up above there, Steve Rinella gets a deer, and then he does something that I never saw Marlon Perkins do. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen anybody on any of the sporting show do what you do, which is you say, okay, now here's my knife. My dad, I think I remember this, my dad used to go out and he would hunt deer and he'd make me skin them. and gut them. And so I learned how to do it, and here's how you do it. And then you show how not to pierce the membrane. I think that's my favorite moment.
Oh, you know, that we were conceptualizing this show. A conversation we had again and again was to show the real, raw, gritty details of it.
Yeah.
And it was something that mattered to everybody who's involved in it, and just to not present a sanitized version. Because I'll tell you, no matter what you feel about hunting, okay, pro-hunting, anti-hunting, I would prefer that when you think about it and when you make decisions about it, that you're armed with as much information as possible. So I would rather portray it and show the gory parts and the ugly parts, because I just think it's important to see the entire package. It's important for everyone to see the entire package. As for stuff about my dad, it's funny because he would bow hunt a lot in the mornings. And there's a couple times he would hit a deer in the morning with his bow and just come down to school and get me to go blood trail it for him. And I remember one time I was in school suspension because I had
that is so you know, familiar
to
me.
School or got late all the time, so I had to go to ISS, they called it. And my dad hits a deer, and he goes down to get me, and they're like, "Well, no, because he's not in the regular school. He's over in the building for ISS." So he's completely unfazed by this, goes over to the ISS building and requests, and it just so happens the guy that ran ISS belonged to the Muskegon Bowman's Association. So winds up that he's like, "Oh, you hit a deer, no problem." And I got to go home and track the deer.
Yeah.
And got it.
So. Yeah. Well, where I grew up was people came all over to northern Pennsylvania to get the deer because they were so big at the time. You know, you could get a buck, it was 170 pounds or so. And so I'm very, very familiar with that. And the whole deal of the first day of buck season, there was no school. There was no point in it.
Yeah, you know, areas like north of me, but areas north of where I grew up, Michigan, you'd get that. Always November 15th, you know, people would get off. And I think that, you know, it's interesting thing is a lot of parts of the country, people talk about declining hunter numbers. And I haven't fully looked into these numbers, but what I feel like, if there's a decline in something, I feel like you might have a decline in very part-time hunters, like non-committal hunters, guys who might go out for one day, you know, and hunt. But what I see, this is from not empirical, but just from my own personal perspective, what I see is an increase in passionate, devoted hunters who are looking at their region, their own regions, and trying to make good decisions about, you know, like I said, supplementing your food and preserving habitat on a local level. And I don't see any real drop in the interest in hunting in an actual sense. I think that there might be a tapering off in license purchases, but I see in my mind, especially my generation, a whole new renewed and very invigorated interest in hunting.
It could be, but I think overall there is a demographic thing where there's a real problem in this country with a lot of young people who are playing video games instead of going out. But we're not going to have time to go there because we only got about 4 minutes. But let's go to Caroline joining the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Steve Ranella.
Yes, good morning, Steve. Thank you. So many areas here, and I'm glad you're approaching your show from a myriad of issues. Predator control in Alaska would be good if it was approached from the standpoint of the rich coming in from Europe where they have no game, buying a huge amount of money, going out to a lodge which has encroached upon the rural villages and taking the game. Also, you mentioned
you're in fine fettle today, Caroline.
Oh, I always am, Steve, as you know.
There's modest proposals for us here.
The vegans, could we be vegans if we had to eat only what grew in our area? I don't think so. So much of what we get, I mean, I grew up canning watermelon rind preserves. They were local. We didn't grow peaches, so they came out of Georgia for our peach preserves, which there's nothing better than peach preserves on a cold December morning on your mom's homemade biscuits. Mm. Nothing better. Those things were grown locally. We grew our own vegetables as much as we could. raised our chickens, et cetera. But everything comes in from all over the world now. We pay a horrendous price. We would wear fur if we didn't have polyurethane. I mean, all of these things, it's a matter of convenience because of what we can get from other places, but we pay a price for that. We chop
down. It's convenience and luxury, for sure. And I think that people who do live that lifestyle, I feel like they should own up to the fact that it is a luxury of being a very wealthy country.
Yeah, but
exactly.
I mean, in Alaska, if something happened where the boats couldn't dock for about a week, we'd start having problems.
Steve, you mentioned something that someone else said to me one time. If the boats didn't come, we'd be hungry and naked because most people aren't making their clothes anymore. I mean, just basic sewing.
Yeah.
And Cooperative Extension, I think they could do a workshop every weekend on canning of meat and salmon as well as the vegetables. So I encourage people to become more self-sufficient, even if they don't need to, because there's not a better sense of security than being able to provide for yourself.
All right, Caroline, thank you. Stu and Muldoon.
Yeah, well put.
Stu and Muldoon, quickly now.
Okay, I look forward to seeing the show. Could you also include out-of-state hunting license fees? The Eat Local movement's been all over this radio station. You might want to mention carbon footprint. And the big thing is, what are you going to do when you return to your place that you showed on TV and find fire pits, saw cuts, trash, human waste piles, and things like that? Because, you know, when you tell people about a nice place.
Well, let me back up now. I want to take all these on the thing.
Oh,
yeah,
wait a minute. You'll never get to them. We got about 30 seconds here.
Non-resident license fees are real expensive. I would love to get to them all, man. We're running out of time. You should have called earlier.
But your special.
I would love to talk about that.
This idea of disclosing the special place being kind of a make them in a honeypot that draws people.
Yeah, you know, I think that I'm sensitive about that in some places, but I just don't. You know, I'm an information guy, man. I like to present things to people, and I don't. The peculiarity of the area, I don't think it's going to be an issue. If people did come out, I can't remember what it was, clear cuts and fire pits.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a huge problem there.
Well, when you maybe we can close by you going back to this theme of the Wild Within and why you came up with that name, because I thought that was a great thought.
Well, again, just to point back out, there's this quote from this guy, Thomas Whipple, served in World War I and died of injuries sustained there, you know, later in the 1930s, and he had this thing he said where this always resonated with me, that a long time ago, we lived in the wild and had civilization inside us, and now we live in civilization and have the wild inside us. And so I think about that most days.
Thank you so much, Steve Rinella, for being with us. I wish we could have spent more time talking about buffalo, maybe another time.
We'll do it next time. I'd love to.
All right. Good luck with the show. Thanks to Dave Waldron at the controls, Josh Edge and Kristen Spack on the telephones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.